This is part two of a lesson that I began last week, a lesson titled Acceptable Exceptions. And I want to impress upon you, especially those of you who were not present for the lesson last week, that this is a very relevant, very practical lesson. We're talking about how we know when we should make an exception to what God has commanded us to do. We do make exceptions. Let me give you one that is very recent, and it was a major exception. Ordinarily, we follow the scriptures to meet here upon the first day of the week, to partake of the Lord's Supper and engage in other activities God has instructed us to do. Well, almost exactly 3 years ago, COVID-19 hit in a big way. And what did we do? We decided that it would be best for our welfare not to meet for a while. And we did not meet for a while. We made an exception to the command, for instance, in Hebrews 10, verse 25, not to assemble ourselves together for our own safety. Hebrews 10, 25 tells us that we are to assemble together. But we didn't do that for a while, for a matter of weeks. We made an exception. Should we have done that? Now, of course, that was a very unusual situation. But there have been other reasons, typically very bad weather conditions, that have sometimes caused us to make an exception to the command to meet on the first day of the week. So I say that to say, this is a very relevant question for us. Now, last week we emphasized the fact that sometimes people in the scriptures were confronted with this very same question. And in the ministry of Jesus, it usually centered around the matter of what you could do on the Sabbath day and what you were not supposed to do on the Sabbath day. The Jews, as Jesus pointed out, made exceptions to the Sabbath command not to work or to exert themselves. For some things, they would exert themselves. But when it came to miraculous healing, in which Jesus did exert his power, and you might say worked, well, the Jews saw that as an unacceptable exception. At least their leaders did. And Jesus pointed out their inconsistency about that. But that brings us up to about where we left off last week. We looked in last week's lesson basically at the fact of exceptions. Now, as we proceed, we want to ask ourselves, when are exceptions acceptable? Do we have some guidelines in the scriptures to help us in determining when those exceptions are acceptable? There have been, or there can be, problems and abuses to making exceptions. I mentioned, as an example, a moment ago, some people back in early 2020 decided that the church should not meet for a matter of weeks. Well, some might have extended that to a matter of months, and we might question, well, was that too long? Now, we might not agree on the answer to a question like that, but that's the reason for this lesson this morning, to try to bring us at least closer together in answering questions like this. I've known of people to get very upset at me when I have recommended to the church, because of very bad weather, icy conditions, the church not meet on a particular first day of the week. They disagreed with me about my recommendation to the church not to meet. But I'm just making the point now that there can be problems and abuses on this subject. The first problem with making exceptions to God's commandments is determining which exceptions are allowable, because making exceptions can be sometimes very subjective, it can be very willful on the part of some people, very arbitrary on the part of some people. Let me give you an example. Why is it that exceptions can be made regarding the setting or the place for the Lord's Supper, and only then perhaps when people might be traveling, while no exceptions can be made as to the day when the Lord's Supper is to be partaken of, or no exceptions can be made to the elements for the Lord's Supper? Why one part of the pattern, but not the other parts of the pattern? For instance, I imagine just about every brother would object if someone said, well, I can meet with the church for the Lord's Supper on Saturday, but not on Sunday. I think brethren would object then. But I have known of brethren to be traveling or for some other reason. Well, we can partake on Sunday, but not with the church, not in the assembly of the church, which is also part of the pattern. So I'm just saying there's inconsistency among brethren about this. And thus, a basic problem with making exceptions is that once it is accepted that people may decide when to make exceptions, those exceptions can become the rule. Because once exceptions are allowed, people want to make more and more exceptions. And thus they do become the rule. Becomes the point where there is no stopping place for these exceptions. Because people who do not want to be hindered by the rules can always rationalize that the exceptions that they want are just as acceptable as the exceptions that other people would make. So that's one of the problems here. Which exceptions are acceptable and which ones are not? Second problem is similar to that. Who is to say which exceptions are acceptable and which ones are not? What qualifies one person to say that this exception is acceptable, but not other exceptions? God has not given anyone the authority to grant exceptions to the patterns of His Word when He Himself has not made any exceptions therein. Now, we'll deal with this a little bit more later on, but sometimes I will acknowledge that some of the exceptions that we might make are implicit in the Scriptures, not specifically stated. But let me move on and give you some outstanding examples of possible exceptions which might be made or have been made. I'm just giving you exceptions. I'm not saying that I agree with them or disagree with them. As a matter of fact, in some cases, I would vigorously disagree with them. But I'm just giving you some examples here. A question might be raised regarding the levirate law. The word levirate means brother-in-law in Hebrew. And according to Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10, if there were a couple of brothers, one of them was married, and he died and left his widow without children, then the living brother was to marry his brother's widow and raise up children to continue at least the legal line of his deceased brother. I know that doesn't sound very good, the idea of marrying your sister-in-law, but that's what the levirate law was all about. It was to continue the family line of the deceased brother. But a question has been raised about this. What happens if the living brother was already married? Was he still to take his deceased brother's widow and marry her? That, of course, would have God setting up a polygamous marriage. And God, in effect, then approving of polygamy, at least in that case. Now, the Scriptures do not address that specific point. So we have to ask ourselves, if the living brother is already married, is he still obligated to marry the widow of his deceased brother according to the levirate law? Do we make an exception there? Well, as I said, the Bible does not specifically deal with that. But I would say, yes, an exception would be made there because otherwise God would be seen as requiring a polygamous marriage. And I cannot believe that God would do that. But otherwise, in order to prevent a situation like this, it was probably the practice that older brothers would be expected to marry and have children before younger ones married. There is a similar situation raised about this about the Sadducees when they were trying to discredit the concept of the resurrection in Matthew 22 when they say there was this one woman married to seven brothers. Each of the brothers died successively without giving children to his wife. And they asked, in the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will she be? Because all seven had her. So it's not exactly the situation that we're looking at, but it does draw attention to the difficulty that might be involved here. Another example, and this one is not from the Scriptures themselves, but I cite 1 Maccabees 2. The books of Maccabees are among the Apocrypha, not part of the Bible, so I just cite it here for its historical value. But this is an interesting situation. The Maccabean revolt of the Jews against their foreign rulers occurred about 160 years before Jesus was born in Judea. And when this revolt first started, some of the Jews went and hid themselves in caves. Well, the enemy forces came out against them, tried to get them to surrender, to come out of their caves, or to fight, or whatever. These Jews refused to do that. They refused even to fight. They refused to defend their lives and the lives of their family members, because it was the Sabbath. And if they had engaged in combat on the Sabbath, they would have violated the Sabbath law against working on the Sabbath. 1,000 of them were killed as a result. No doubt, women and children slaughtered by the enemy, because on the Sabbath they refused to exert themselves, even to defend themselves and their families. And they decided, if this keeps up like this, our enemy is... They just figure out, okay, we'll come against them on the Sabbath day when they can't fight, we'll slaughter them, and we'll be killed. So they decided, you know what, we're going to make an exception to the Sabbath law in order to engage in combat for self-defense. And then here's another example. An exception was supposedly made for immersion or baptism in the case of what has been called clinical baptism. I should put that in air quotes, clinical baptism. Clinical and clinical baptism comes from the Greek word kline, K-L-I-N-E, which was the Greek word for bed. In clinical baptism, as it was called, when anyone was deemed too sick to rise from his bed, perhaps he was even on his deathbed, but he needed to be baptized, again, air quotes around baptized. In that case, he was not immersed. Water was brought to him and he was sprinkled with water. So an exception would be made for baptism or immersion in a case like that. Another example. Substitutions have been made, or at least suggested, for grape juice when it could not be obtained for the Lord's Supper. Here's an interesting case. This question arose when Europeans first came to the New World and they found out, well, there are no grapes here. At least not like what we had in Europe. Let me read what an author by the name of Alfred W. Crosby, Jr. says about this from his book, The Columbian Exchange. And the Columbian Exchange is a reference to the exchange of plants and animals between what were called the Old and the New Worlds. But he starts off by saying, all the others, that is, New World plants, were strange, leading to all sorts of difficulties. With no grapes, how were the Europeans to make the wine needed to celebrate the Lord's Supper? Was it better to forego the ceremony until wine could be obtained from Europe? Or to operate on the theory that Jesus used wine only because it was common in Palestine and that therefore his sacrifice of himself on the cross could be commemorated with one of the local Indian beverages? Actually, I've heard of situations before where I would hope that they would be rather local and very temporary situations, but where brethren had trouble getting grape juice for the Lord's Supper. What do you do in situations like that? Can you make an exception and substitute something like maybe cranberry juice, orange juice? What do you do? Of course, the Mormons substitute water for grape juice in communion. Let me go on to another exception here. When I was a teenager in high school, I was surprised to find out that the Roman Catholics had made a change. They decided you could celebrate or participate in what they called Sunday Mass on Saturday night, a different day. And one more big example, situation ethics. Situation ethics is basically what the name sounds like. Your ethics, your morality, or your moral conduct may change depending on the situation or the circumstances in which you find yourself. I think he was an Episcopalian theologian, a fellow by the name of Joseph Fletcher, came out with a book titled Situation Ethics. And basically he said you can violate all sorts of God's moral laws, you can make exceptions to them if answering the call of love in a particular situation would seem to require you to do that. That's a big subject, and I'm not going to deal any more specifically with it right now. I simply cite it now to show that, yes, this can be a very relevant question. People have proposed exceptions to God's instructions in His Word. So again, we go back to the question, when are exceptions acceptable? Well, to answer that question, since many exceptions may be made to parts of some of God's patterns, as we've shown, the question arises as to which of these exceptions is acceptable and under what circumstances would they be acceptable. We make exceptions, how do we justify making them? My first answer to that is, and it must be observed, and this is a matter of the greatest importance, that God's moral laws admit absolutely no exceptions. There are never times when people are permitted by God to commit adultery, to commit fornication, to murder, to lie, etc. And this is evident from the fact that God never broke any of His own moral laws. He never told others to break moral laws. And there is never any indication of His approval of any of His people or other people breaking moral laws. In Titus 1 verse 2, it says, God cannot lie, as a matter of fact. But also, it is obvious that people may make exceptions where and when God made them. As we observed last week, there were times when God did specify His own exceptions. There is a notable one in Numbers, the 9th chapter, where people, because of uncleanness, were not able to partake of the Passover in the first month. And God said, okay, well, you can partake of it on the 14th day of the second month, if you can't do it in the first month. That's an example of an exception that God made. So we can make the exceptions that God Himself has made. However, this only reinforces the idea that people must be careful not to make exceptions where God did not make them. For otherwise, there would have been no need for God to specify these exceptions if we could just make them whenever we wanted to. And then, when non-moral commandments of God are involved, and sometimes brethren refer to non-moral commandments of God, that is, don't involve a matter of morality, as positive commandments. So when positive or non-moral commandments of God, such as attendance at the assemblies of the church, come under consideration for this purpose, that is, for the purpose of deciding can we make an exception or not, we've got to concede that some of these decisions become subjective. Now, when I mean subjective, I mean they may vary from person to person. One person may agree, another person may disagree about making this or that exception. So I'm going to concede that in some cases, some of these exceptions have to be left to an individual's private judgment. And again, a good example of this is the classic one. We say that if people are too sick to come to the assemblies, then they're not required to do so. They may make an exception to the commandment of God to assemble. Well, how do you define too sick? Okay, I've got a sore thumb today. I'm just not well. I can't come. A person like that might have an infected thumb, and if you challenge them about it, maybe they could defend it. I couldn't drive under those conditions. Would it be not safe for me to drive? So sometimes in our minds we may question, well, could that person really have come? Was that person really too sick or unable physically to come? And we ultimately decide, I think this is what it has to come down to, unless it becomes obviously abused and repeatedly so. We say, well, we'll have to leave that to that person's own judgment, and they will answer to God for it. Furthermore, this shows that some exceptions God allows are implicit. That is, God doesn't specifically make these exceptions in His Word. Examples of this are, as I just mentioned, a degree of sickness. By the way, Paul said, in 2 Timothy 4, verse 20. Trophimus I left sick at Miletus. Now, that's not specifically referring to attendance at an assembly of the church, but it does show that for purposes of sickness, a person sometimes might not be able to go about his ordinary service to God. But also sometimes weather conditions. Paul was stuck on a ship that was racked by a storm for weeks, as a matter of fact, in Acts the 27th chapter. He wasn't able to serve God under those circumstances as he would ordinarily do so. We're told in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, if any man will not work, neither let him eat. We're required to work for our living. Well, sometimes there might be work interferences. And again, this raises a question of, well, how often or how long can you allow work to interfere with your attendance? We encourage people not to let that happen, especially on a regular basis. But I'm just saying these questions come up. And so it is possible for this consideration to be so abused that sometimes the church might have to step in and make a judgment about this individual's application. And there's indication of that in Matthew 18, verses 15 through 17. Beyond this, though, the simplest answer as to when exceptions may be made to God's instructions is that an exception may be made when a person has no choice but to make that exception. And that doesn't entirely answer the question, but it is to say that God does not require people to do what they cannot physically do or what they cannot morally do. Part of this has to do with the fact that an exception must sometimes be made to a lesser law that a greater law might be fulfilled. And I think that was why Jesus, in Matthew the 12th chapter, verse 7, quoted from Hosea 9, verse 9, when his disciples were criticized for taking a relatively small amount of the grain out of the grain fields and eating it on the Sabbath day. Some people said, well, they shouldn't be doing that. That's working on the Sabbath day. That's violating the Sabbath law. And Jesus says this about that, quoting from Hosea 6, verse 7. But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. I desire compassion and not a sacrifice. And this is a principle also stated in Psalm 51, verses 16 and 19. In other words, sometimes the compassion is more important than the physical sacrifice itself. Again, this principle is supported in the Old Testament, specifically Psalm 51. I'll read now verses 16 and 19. For thou dost not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. Thou art not pleased with burnt offering. Verse 19, then thou wilt delight in righteous sacrifices, in burnt offerings and whole burnt offerings. Then young bulls will be offered on thine altar. So at first he says in verse 19, you don't desire sacrifices. And then he goes on to say, but you do desire righteous sacrifices. And sometimes if sacrifices couldn't be made righteously or in a manner that was commensurate with or agreed with the honoring of some higher principles, then the sacrifices would have to be foregone. For instance, the moral obligation to aid in an emergency must be fulfilled, even if it means making an exception to what we've called one of the positive commandments of God. An example of this would be if you're on your way to the assemblies of the church, you're fulfilling your obligation to do that according to the scriptures, but you come upon a serious accident. Maybe you need to stop and render aid to the victims. Well, there's a higher law there, a moral law that calls upon you to forego assembling with the saints in order to render aid to the victims of the accident. Now, I say a higher law. The expression that Jesus uses is weightier law. In Matthew 23, verse 23, he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others." Jesus refers to weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. So he implies there that if it is our duty, if there's a clash between some less weighty provisions of the law and the weightier provisions of the law, we have to go with the weightier provisions. So, if you will, we have to make an exception. And Jesus pointed out, as I think we observed last week, that abstaining from exertion, work, if you will, on the Sabbath was not as important as taking care of livestock, tending to the sick and endangered in various places, like Luke 13 here and 14. He mentions if your son or your animal falls into a well on the Sabbath, what are you going to do? Oh, I can't exert myself on the Sabbath. No, you're going to rescue your son. Why? Because there's a higher law involved there. You're saving human life. So there's an exception to Sabbath observance in that case. Abstaining from exertion on the Sabbath was not as important as worship, he pointed out. He said in Matthew 12, verse 5, that the priest in the temple profaned the Sabbath. Why? Because they're offering sacrifices on the Sabbath. They're doing work on the Sabbath day. They're worshiping God. That's more important. Pointed out in John 7, verses 22 and 23, that circumcising a son on the eighth day of his life took precedence over the Sabbath. Because sometimes that eighth day fell on the Sabbath. What are you going to do? You circumcise your son. Offering emergency aid was something that the priest and the Levite should have done for the robbery victim in the story of the Good Samaritan in Luke the 10th chapter. Even though the priest and the Levite said, well, the scriptures specifically tell us not to defile ourselves by touching a dead body. And that man might be dead. No. Your greater obligation there, it's a moral obligation, is to try to render aid, even if it makes you ceremonially unclean. An exception has to be made in that case to the law about ceremonial cleanliness, if I may use that terminology. A critically important point here, though, is this. What Jesus is contemplating in these situations is a lack of choice on the part of the person. Jesus contemplates situations which a person had not chosen, but which are pressed upon him by external forces beyond his control. If your son or your animal falls into a well on the Sabbath day, and you have to get that animal out, that was not your choice. You didn't force the animal. You didn't force your son into the well. You didn't make a choice about that. It just happened. Those were the circumstances that came upon you. So when we make choices about exceptions, and we could be doing something else, that can't be supported by the kinds of exceptions that Jesus was talking about for the Sabbath day law. And let me mention something else here. If one cannot lie or steal to satisfy his want, according to Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9, neither can he do so to achieve a higher standard of living. Let's look in Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9. I think this has something relevant for us on this subject. That's Proverbs chapter 30, verses 8 and 9. There the writer says, "Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be in want and steal and profane the name of my God." So being in want does not allow us to put ourselves in a position where we steal and profane the name of God and things like that. God also does not allow people to make exceptions which are substitutes for what he has instructed. Now, our question here is whether people may be relieved of their obligation to obey God, not whether they may put something in the place of what He has commanded. And thus it is a matter of whether someone will or will not do something, not whether something may be done in its place. And hence, what we see from the Scriptures is this teaching. One either does what God has commanded, or if he cannot, then he is not obligated to do it at all. And we see that principle stated in 1 Samuel 13, verses 1 through 14, where King Saul thought he was in a situation where he simply had to offer sacrifices rather than waiting for Samuel, as he had been instructed, to arrive and offer those sacrifices. He even said he forced himself. He thought the circumstances constrained him to do other than what God had said. No, he just simply should not have offered the sacrifices. If you can't do what God said, then just don't do it. Don't put something in its place. How would that apply to some of the situations we have raised today? If you simply cannot obtain unleavened bread or grape juice to partake of the Lord's Supper, instead of substituting something for them and partaking of what you would call the Lord's Supper, you simply do not partake of the Lord's Supper. You would be excused from partaking of the Lord's Supper in that sort of situation. While God has allowed people not to do what they could not do, He has never allowed them to change His word, if they could not do it, by putting substitutes in the place of what He has instructed. So, King Jeroboam was condemned because he put members of other tribes in place of the Levites and the Levitical priest to offer sacrifices and so forth. Those were substitutes. Those were condemned. Substitutes for what God has commanded are not allowed. If you can't do it, don't substitute something that God has not allowed or authorized. Just don't do it. In such a case, if you can't do what God said, then God has excused you from doing it. In conclusion, the subject of exceptions has to do directly with whether people are required to obey God. That's how very practical these two lessons have been. We're simply talking about, do we have to obey God? And if there are exceptions that we must make to His laws, to His instructions, when are those exceptions to be made? When are they allowable? When are they acceptable? God might make exceptions for some who do not comply entirely with His commandments. I'm thinking of the situation now in 2 Chronicles 30, verses 10 through 20. But God distinguishes between those who are willfully disobedient and those who try to do their best. And that's where the situation in 2 Chronicles 30, verses 1 through 20 gives us some hope for God's mercy. But we have to ask ourselves, are we just willfully ignoring what God has said and neglecting His instructions? Or might He extend mercy to us in situations when we have not fully complied, but have nevertheless done what we have thought was the best that we can do? And yet, we need to bear in mind that when it comes to extending mercy in situations like this, that's His decision. And we don't know what His decision might be. We always have to do our best. The reason I emphasize that is because some people may take the situation in 2 Chronicles 30, verses 1 through 20, and I'm not specifying it because I have done so in previous lessons, and I won't take the time to do it now. But some may take that situation, and they may say, oh, that allows us to act upon what we would think will be the mercy and the grace and the leniency of God. No, that's an assumption. This situation described in 2 Chronicles 30, verses 1 through 20, does not mean that people may act on the assumption that He makes the exceptions they feel the need or they feel the desire to make. Exceptions cannot be made arbitrarily and with impunity to God's commandments. It might be that there is someone here today who, because of something I've said or something that has been said in their experience recently, feel the need to be more compliant with God's commandments, to be more careful in adhering to His patterns and His instructions, particularly when it comes to what people need to do to be saved from their sins. Scriptures have told us, and there are no exceptions to this, that we know of, having heard the Word of God, we need to come to believe in Jesus of Nazareth as the Son of God, then repent of our sins, change our minds about those sins, and turn our backs upon them. We need then to confess with our mouth Jesus as Lord, and finally be baptized, immersed in a body of water for the forgiveness of our sins. I know of no exceptions that can be made to that. If there are those exceptions, they will have to be made by God. We cannot make them. It may be that some here have complied with those instructions regarding salvation, but since then have fallen away and wish to be renewed in their relationship with God and with His people by confession of sins here before us today. If that is your need and your desire, we encourage you to come forward by the singing of the song. Let us stand and sing then.